Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Good evening, and welcome to the LSE. I'm Dr. Armina Ishkanyan. I'm an assistant professor in the Department of Social Policy and also the program director of the Social Policy and Development and NGOs Master's Program. I'm very pleased to be here to introduce the London premiere of When Elephants Fight, a documentary on how multinational corporations and corrupt politicians in Democratic Republic of the Congo threaten human rights. The film that we'll be watching in a few minutes is narrated by Robin Wright from the House of Cards and was produced with LSC alumnus Kwame Marfo, who's in the audience with us tonight, and he's the international executive producer. I'll be introducing the panelists once we get on stage for the Q&A. But I just, before we begin the film, I would like to ask the audience if you can turn your phones to silent. You don't need to turn them off. And for those of you who are on Twitter, we do have a hashtag. Is it on there? Yes, it's LSC Congo. So please tweet if you'd like. And this evening's event is being recorded, and it will hopefully be made available as a podcast, subject to no technical difficulties. And after the film screening, there will be a chance for you to put your questions forward to the panelists. I hope that you will enjoy the film screening of When Elephants Fight. I think I'm going to begin. That was an incredible film. I think the message has come across loud and clear, and I think the question of what is our ethical responsibility is something that is going to stay with me and with hopefully others. I'm now pleased to welcome the panelists for the Q&A. I'll start from my left. Mr. Bandi Mububi is director of Congo Calling, working for the ethical management of natural resources in the DRC. Next is Peter Jones. Mr. Peter Jones, he works for Global Witness, an NGO researching corruption in DRC's mining and oil sectors, and was previously the Reuters DRC correspondent. And at the end is Mr. J.D. Steyer, is an award-winning producer and campaign director, and is president of Steer Forward, based in New York City. We are actually going to begin with some remarks from the panelists, and then I will turn it over to the audience for Q&A questions.
Thank you, Doctor, and thank you all for attending this evening. There was a line near the end of the film where a gentleman looked into the camera as so many Congolese do. You come here to take our picture. You come here to share stories of suffering. We want to see the results. We wish you well. And this has been going on far too long, far too many cameras. And it's that focus on results that inspired this film. And it's the reason why we're here at arguably the world's most elite educational institution. It just so happens to be down the street from Glencore's headquarters. We started out this process 5 years ago with that determination, and things have changed over the course of the last 5 years as it pertains to results inside Congo, amongst civil society, and through international advocacy. We're at a tipping point. We're at a tipping point that could so easily backslide and set Congo up for another few decades of corruption. I want to focus my remarks on results, and thankfully we're here with, you know, one of the leaders of Congolese civil society and one of the leaders truly of the international community's research pinpointing the big money in corruption. Civil society has never been more organized and unified than it is today in Congo and internationally. Increasingly speaking with one voice, we have successfully advocated for U.S. legislation, international legislation. These are initiatives that get the ball rolling. Transparency is a starting point towards long-term reform. Apple and Intel have responded, mapped their supply chains, initiated the large-scale transparency needed, but that's small scale compared to the mining companies, and that's what the film does. It starts in the East with artisanal mining, broadens the narrative to include what's happening in the South, the big money, part of the reason why the Congolese government is relatively immune to internal and external pressures. The film is an organizing tool. We didn't set out to make a film so we could all come together and watch it, listen to a panel, and go home. Documentary film is increasingly a powerful tool to meet people who are disinterested, unmotivated from reading policy publications and more in-depth reporting, yet we can move the general public to a more expert level of understanding through that tool. The film is housed within the Stand With Congo campaign, a united player behind groups including Malaika, whose founder is present tonight, Congo Calling, whose founder joins us on stage, and groups throughout the Congo. This organizing tool looks to share a new narrative. Congo's story is not of suffering and desperation, but of a handful of kleptocratic elite and tens of millions of people ready and organized and working towards change. We share these new narratives through the film and across social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and standwithcongo.org. We ask you tonight to explore within yourselves what you're willing to do, how much you're willing to share what we've been working on for all these years. And as we continue to gain momentum, ultimately we would like to ask Glencore, and we'd like you to join us in asking Glencore, to lead. Lead in the way that Steve Jobs and Tim Cook after him have led. Lead in the way Brian Krzanich, CEO of Intel, has led. This is a business decision. This is a calculation on their part and on the part of their shareholders. Is this worth addressing? Far too few people speak up. And all we need is a handful more of Congolese, university students, business and industry leaders to ask questions, to spark this conversation, to be willing to share this on their social media networks. It was shocking to me before I handed over to Pete how few people spoke up in the United States to get Apple, the world's largest company, Intel, the world's largest chip manufacturer, engaged. We organized a campaign in 2012 that ultimately organized 165 campuses. That's not too much. That's not that many. That's what we're here today to do. That's what we're a part of sparking. And never has there been a more critical time for engagement than today. So thank you for coming out. Looking forward to the Q&A.
Thank you. Peter.
Thanks very much. Thanks, JD. I'm going to keep my comments fairly short because I'm interested to hear about the questions that you're going to come up with. Just to say, forgive me for referring to my notes during this. Some of the work that I have been engaged in involves people and companies that are fairly litigious, so there are certain moments where I have to be quite on point with what I'm saying. But just to say that, yes, I work on the formal sector, the issues that were raised in the film related to Katanga province. So we're talking about the industrial mining sector in DRC and the huge losses we've seen to DRC through these suspicious, shady deals. We confront corruption in DRC, but from my point of view, it's really the international systems and structures that facilitate these kinds of deals that require our attention, especially here in the West. One thing that has been quite shocking is that in looking at a number of these deals, they always seem to involve companies incorporated in the British Virgin Islands. As the film mentioned, that's something we in the UK need to take very seriously. The UK government has the power to remove this veil of secrecy, which has allowed a lot of these deals to take place. And that is something that we can really exert some pressure on. So I've worked a good deal on this character, Dan Gertler. Maybe there'll be questions about him. We can go into some more depth, quite a colorful character. We've updated the actual figure for the losses to Congo. We've included an oil deal now that he was involved in 2014. So in just six deals that he was involved in, we now think he lost well, those deals lost the state about $1.5 billion. It's an insane amount of money. Dan Gertler's role is as a gatekeeper for huge companies. If they want to get preferential access to Congo's mineral riches, they have to work through Dan Gertler. In a bit of an update since the film was made, in an actually positive piece of news, especially for us, you know, we've been pretty much banging on about Dan Gertler for about 5 or 6 years, and it didn't seem like anybody was taking that much interest. But just last month in the US, the SEC and the Department of Justice came to an agreement with a US hedge fund called OCSIF. Under some filings against OCSIF under US anti-corruption law, OCSIF had been working with Dan Gertler in DRC, and its subsidiary essentially admitted guilt in a huge bribery conspiracy in DRC. It had to pay up over $400 million. And there's some astonishing evidence that's been put out by the SEC. So what you'll have noticed, Michael Kavanaugh from Bloomberg speaking in the film has said, can I prove that there was corruption? No, I can't. But these deals, the discrepancies in the amounts paid and then the amounts received subsequently by the British Virgin Islands companies makes you think something must be wrong. Well, now we have the SEC telling us that the involvement of a infamous Israeli businessman, who is widely understood to be Dan Gertler, using financing from OCSIF, the hedge fund, paying bribes to high-ranking Congolese government officials. So it's a really important step forward. Again, the reason I'm referring to my notes, just to remind myself that I should say at this point that Dan Gertler and the various companies he's worked with deny any wrongdoing. They say everything's above board. I'm sure you can judge for yourself whether that's accurate. And one of the questions in the film I think is really quite vital and really important to the work that I do is a lot of the people in the film ask, where is this money going? There is great, huge riches in DRC, but where is it going? We just don't know. One thing that I'd like to just raise, as I think is a very important shift, is the change in Gécamines, the state mining company, and the function that that company performs in DRC's economy. In its 1980s heyday, it was a producer of minerals, but it transitioned to being more of a custodian of Congo's mineral rights by owning the rights to the land. It then has to rely on joint ventures with international companies in order to exploit those riches. And what we've seen is that that is very susceptible to corruption, that it's striking terrible joint ventures for Congo and is very susceptible to corruption. And another facet of the international community's financial structures and the offshore systems shows how Congo can lose out. So just recently, Freeport-McMoRan, a massive US mining company, owns the massive majority of the massive TFM mine in Congo, has decided to sell up, selling its stake to China Moly, a Chinese mining company, for over $2.5 billion. But Congo gets none of it, absolutely not a penny, because what has actually happened is that Freeport is selling a Bermuda holding company, which holds the rights to the mine. It's not selling the mine itself. There's no capital gains tax for Congo. It's seeing absolutely nothing. So I just want to circle back and think about, why is this corruption important? And for us, one of the underlying principles of our work is that corruption erodes democracy. We're seeing that in DRC today. Corrupt leaders and corrupt elites will go to greater and greater extremes, especially on the humanitarian front, abuse of civilians, in order to cling on to the power and the wealth that they've generated. And we're seeing that in the political crisis that's unraveling in Congo right now. I think I can hand over to Bandy.
Thank you.
Well, it's really good to have you, and it's good to have JD on the platform and Peter. So I'm Congolese, and I'm going to give you a Congolese perspective in what is happening at the moment in the Congo. I think most people in Congo are really thinking about the elections, the fact that the current president and part of the political elite in the Congo do not want to hold elections within the Congo. And part of the reason they're doing that is because they don't want to leave power. And just like the two speakers have highlighted, part of why they want to keep it in power is because, and why they're not, why they're immune to any kind of pressure is also because they have access to a lot of money, and they've been selling companies to offshore companies and then rebuying them and then making so much money out of it. And because of so much money, it's really easy for them to stay in power because they have access to money and then they keep on doing the same thing. So in the Congo, the civil society is well organized and they pushing for democratic institutions to take hold of the state so that we can have credible elections to take place. But unfortunately, you know, the government is pushing back. And just to give an example, like last month, people demonstrated, they wanted free and fair elections in September, and over 100 people were killed. If you believe other institutions like the UN, it's maybe less than 100 people, maybe 50 people. And if you want to take the government statistics, then you go down to 30 people who were killed. But that's a lot of people dying, you know, in just 2 days of demonstrations. And much of that violence came from the government because they're really pushing back and wanting to remain in power. And that has been the case for, you know, for much of our history, that those who those rulers want to hold on to power. We had a dictatorship for about 32 years, which then, when that dictatorship was ended, we got into another kind of dictatorship until we had the current constitution that we have, which was brokered via armed groups who negotiated peace and agreed to have a referendum, which led to the first elections after a long, long time in 2006. So that has continued. So you have, on the one hand, a regime that wants to hold on to power, and on the other, you have the population really wanting change and democratic institutions to come about. So really, as well as, you know, addressing the issue of transparency, we also have to think about how democratic institutions can then create the space in which we can have real economic and social transformation within Congolese society, so that actually, in the end, with increased transparency and with the state being able to have more and more money in the treasury, we would then be able to have the possibility, the potential to have real economic and social benefit as a result of democratic institutions. And it's really difficult to see how we can reach that stage if we do not insist on democratic change, on democratic institutions, and on credible elections to be held, so that we can at least restore some kind of legitimacy. Because much of what has happened in the Congo is also that the elite, the political elite that rule us, have lost their legitimacy. The population do not necessarily see them as those who should rule them. And that's a big problem, because then the temptation now from those who rule us is to use force, violence, in order to repress the population. So you have that democratic change, but in order to have it, you really have to have increased pressure in terms of how corporations are getting away with the fact that they can go to the Congo, bribe officials, and then get all sorts of money, and state actors can get a cut out of it and really do whatever they want to do with that money. So transparency, but also we ought to have democratic institutions to bring about that kind of change.
Absolutely. Thank you very much to the panelists for the comments. I will now open the floor to questions. If I could ask all who want to ask a question to please state your name and your affiliation, and to keep your questions relatively brief and to the point, so no speeches, questions. And I'll take groups of three. And there is a microphone. So one, two, and three. Okay. The gentleman there, and the gentleman there. Yes.
Hi, my name is Sasha. I don't have any information.
Just wait for the microphone, please.
My name's Sasha, and I don't have any affiliation, so to speak. The film talks quite a lot about conflict minerals and kind of the tagging of minerals and this kind of closed-loop extraction. But there is actually, organisations like the Enough Project, I know, have been quite instrumental in getting this off the ground. But there is an argument that's kind of emerging, and certainly Professor Rosenblum, who's in the film, has alluded to this outside of the film, that actually the threat isn't so much the conflict minerals themselves, but actually some of these armed groups are now becoming part of the government, have been incorporated into the military, and the mines that they are now in charge of, that money is still being siphoned off, and there's still an enormous amount of corruption in spite of the efforts of the conflict mineral and the tagging process. So from the panel, I'd love to get a perspective as to, you know, what would you say to this? And secondly, are there any alternative schemes and any alternatives that you've seen that you think have any potential?
Thank you.
All right, my name is Muna. I'm an African development student here at LSE. Peter and JD, you mentioned pressure from the campaign for transparency in the dealings of multinational companies. Is there any pressure, or what do you think legislative change would look like in terms of aid and military support transparency? So, for example, the movie mentioned aid being given to Paul Kagame and that being funneled into funding military groups in the Congo. And then, Bandi, you mentioned that democracy and legitimate leadership is a hope for the DRC. I noticed the movie focuses a lot on Katanga. It doesn't mention Moise Katumbi, who was the governor of Katanga, who's heavily involved in mining, could be a credible opponent to Kabila in elections if they do come about. Do you have any views on his involvement or lack thereof and his potential to be a legitimate non-corrupt leader?
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Je vais parler en français, excusez-moi.
Okay.
I'll speak in French, so they're going to be translated.
Okay, can you say his name?
Patrice Kabamba, consultant, Congolais. Okay. I'm Patrice Kabamba, Congolese consultant.
Okay.
Mon constat est la suivante. Ce que nous venons de voir là, c'est quelque chose, c'est une situation qui date des années et des années.
As my constatation is what you have seen here is an ongoing situation for years now.
On nous présente ici que le Congo était un pays en guerre.
The Congo is introduced to be a country in war.
Peut-on nous dire avec quel pays ou bien entre quelle ethnie?
Can we be told with country or which ethnic groups?
So who are the parties in the conflict, is that?
Okay. Yes, please.
Aujourd'hui,
today,
la guerre de minerais, le Congo est victime de ses richesses.
The minerals of war is the cause of Congo to be a victim.
Quelle que soit la situation, ce que nous voulons aujourd'hui, c'est de pouvoir parler autrement avec ceux qui pillent ce pays et qui arment la population contre les autres.
Whatever the situation, we want to be to have a clear talk against with those who are perpetrating all these atrocities and those who are involved and backing those committing those atrocities.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, I'm going to turn to the panel to get some responses around. I'll just repeat the questions around conflict minerals and the role of the militias in running the mines. Is there any pressure on aid, development aid, and what role that's playing? About the governor of Katanga and his possibility of being running for government? And also, what are the parties to the conflict and the situation? So, Bandi, can I start with you? Or unless...
Okay. No, that's fine. Well, I'll perhaps take the question you asked about Katumbi, because I think you addressed that particularly to me. Well, Katumbi, just like any Congolese citizen, is entitled to put his name forward to be the next president. But there are also other people who are running for or want to run for to be presidential candidate. So at the moment, it's really difficult to say who is going to be on top. Katumbi is obviously very popular within Congo, but there are also other actors like Tshisekedi, and you know, many of them, you know, you never know. But I think what is important for people like myself and other civil society leaders, as well as political actors, is the possibility of holding credible elections. And that's really important, because through that we can have legitimacy in those who rule us. And that's essential.
I guess I'll try and tackle the conflict minerals question. I just want to state in advance that, as I said, I work on Katanga mostly, but I do have colleagues who work very intensely in the east of DRC and look at, and you know, and in the neighbouring countries in Rwanda and Uganda, and look at this. I wouldn't ever pretend to be an expert on this issue, but from what I've gathered, you're absolutely right that it's not just armed groups, that many renegade members of the National Army can control entire mines. The National Army will tax mines and tax artisanal miners in the same way that armed groups do. And that it goes right up to the top. So some of the highest ranking army officers in DRC are in control of some very significant mining concessions in the east of the country and in Oriental Province and other areas. What I'd say is that I think this all speaks to a kind of culture of impunity which exists amongst the elites in DRC, and that's something that relates also to the narrow circle of advisors around Kabila who are profiting, the elites who are profiting not just from the control of certain artisanal concessions, but are striking these larger industrial deals as well. Not only that, the lack of governance which allows those kinds of deals and that kind of control of mining sites to happen is something that's being perpetuated almost on purpose. It couldn't really take place in a country which was slightly more under control. And in the East, being as lawless and lacking in infrastructure as it is, it's very, very difficult to monitor each of the mining sites. Some of them can be extremely remote. It's very difficult. You can say that a mining site is free of any armed groups or even army figures 1 month, but then how would you know whether these sorts of figures have returned in a couple of weeks? That's what really poses the problem, and I think this, like I say, at the heart of it is this kind of culture of impunity which lies at the heart of not just the artisanal problems, but also in the industrial sector as well. In terms of alternative schemes, I don't think there's really a scheme that can answer that. Again, we have to look back to having an actual democratic process where the government and the army is being held to account. Reform of the army is something that has been attempted time and time again, and it's just an impossibly complicated question. But paying some of the soldiers properly would stop some of the kind of ad hoc taxation that goes on. And from our side, we have lobbied quite hard within DRC to make changes to the mining laws so that military figures are absolutely banned from working in mining concessions, from owning mining concessions, from owning mining contracts. But changing the law is one thing, but seeing it enforced is another, and it's just a very long, very hard path.
And to piggyback off right there, Section 1502 is currently under threat. The Republican House of Representatives in the United States is trying to defund, hoping that nobody catches wind of this, yet civil society is aware and rapidly organizing to challenge this back in the United States. But it's, you know, you look at Congo's constitution, you look at these provisions, they need support. They need public support. They need funding to follow through. They have the impact that they're going to have. Following up to the question of aid, the UN group of experts documented Rwandan President Kagame's support of armed groups, which is concluded in the film, and civil society successfully petitioned the World Bank to withhold $110 million of annual support to the Rwandan government 3 years ago. And that support has been withdrawn for Rwanda's role in funding and organizing corruption and violence over its border in the Congo. It's an example of the types of reform that civil society has been effective at sparking. I just wanted to quickly touch on the question about parties to the conflict. This is one of the reasons why Congo's conflict has continued for so long. It's complex. I'd say the bad guy is complexity. You just sat through an 80-minute documentary. Think about the depth and breadth of actors and players and historical dynamics and current challenges, and we're at LSE. And so It's bringing this message of complexity, shifting the narrative away from deadliest conflict and rape capital of the world to really pinpointing individuals and a handful of institutions that can be turned into allies and advocates for peace and development. And as we kind of begun the panel, it's really on us now to popularize that movement, to share that movement, and to continue to support what civil society is doing.
Did you want to say something?
Yeah.
Okay.
Just so that people understand why it is really important to have transparency, it's because even in the best of times, even if we get to a situation where we have strong institutions that can hopefully wrestle away some of the money that is being stolen from Congo, because that's the only word I can think of that, you know, is appropriate in this context. Even in the best of times, because of the situation we're in, it's difficult for any for many sub-Saharan states to be able to withstand the kind of money that many of those corporations, multinationals, have. So transparency is really important because of the fact that if people are shifting money and then hiding that money in offshore accounts and no one actually knows who owns those companies, it's really important for people in the Congo and many other countries in similar situation to have allies in the West and to have people who actually demand transparency, because that money being shifted and profiting the elite in the Congo and also profiting the elite, the business elite in the West, is not helping people in the Congo. And it's not also helping people even in the West, because actually those people have more and more money. And if they are already corrupt, that corruption is not going to stay just in the Congo. It's also going to spread across the world. And with that kind of mentality, we, all of us in the West, as well as in Africa, we lose out. So it's that's why it's so important. And as we can see from the film, what has happened is that business interest throughout the whole period, businesses have remained the same. So people have moved money, they've made money at one time or another. And transparency is really, really important to make sure that we cut off that kind of, or we at least reduce that kind of corruption.
Thank you. I have time for one more round of questions. Okay. Okay. All right. One over there. And, okay, you're over there. So, one, two, and three. Okay? And don't worry, we will have a reception afterwards. And if I didn't get a chance to call on you, you can ask your questions there.
Yeah.
Then I gave you a chance. So it's.
Can you hear me on this? All right.
Yes.
Sandra Chevy Press. All right, I want you to find out to what extent the Clintons made a killing on the conflict in Rwanda and as it affected the Congo, and whether, in fact, Bill Clinton, as president, held off in any intervention because he wanted his covert company to make a killing in the Congo.
Okay.
And my last quick question is, I don't understand why the producer or the middle fellow here is dumping the Israelis into this. Why is that? Dump it all on the Israelis.
Okay,
please.
I don't think that was a fair comment.
Bullshit.
Okay. I'm sorry, what was your name? We didn't catch your name. Is your name bullshit? What was your name? No, but what was your name? What? Can you say what your affiliation? I'm asking everybody. What press? Okay. And sir, can you please state your name and your affiliation, please?
Yeah, the name is Dr. Feyo Gunede, and I'm a human rights lawyer. Well, I'm representing an organization called AU Watch. Please permit me to say a few words. And that is absolutely brilliant film.
Okay.
But back to our producers, I think some of the problems we have in Africa is a question of leadership. We have a saying, if you leave your goats to hyenas, and then the hyena eats your goats, you should not wonder why. Now, two questions I have. The African Commission on Human and People's Rights, as the preeminent organization in Africa, that seeks to promote and protect human rights in Africa. As we are speaking right now, they're having a meeting, a biannual meeting in Banjul, the Gambia.
Sir, no speeches. Please get to the question.
They're having a biannual meeting in Banjul. Why didn't you make any effort to contact A, the African Commission, and B, the African Union? Because corruption, and particularly mineral rights, is an issue particularly to the African Commission and the African Union. I would have been very interested to know why. Did you interview the African Union, or was it not very important in your schedule? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And at the bottom row over there, please state your name and your affiliation.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you for the amazing film. My name is Tracy Ilunga, and I'm representing Revive Congo. I actually have a hypothetical question, which is, if there were democratic elections in November and you became president, what would be the first few things that you would do with regards to conflict minerals?
Who is that question directed to?
Just to all three.
Okay. all right, just to review the questions. I'm not included. So the role of the Clintons, the African Union, and if you became president, what would you do? And I think there was a question about the Israeli. Okay. Of why they were brought up. Okay, so if I could start with on this end and work our way. And thank you. Mm-hmm.
Thanks for keeping the audience engaged and asking some fruitful questions. On all seriousness, the campaign's executive producer, LSE alumnus, and the main reason why we're here tonight, Kwame Marfo. Kwame is standing now right there. Thank you for having us all here and working with LSE to bring us. And Kwame expertly pointed out, as you see at the end of the film, the film will not accept money. And so this film can be screened for free anywhere. We have full-time staff, thanks to generosity by civil society, including transparency leaders on the island of Bermuda. We can now fund the film with support from our home base in the United States, giving you all of the supplies you need to promote your event for your local student organization, oftentimes Congolese and Congolese diaspora associations, and giving you the film, again, at no cost. This is part of a movement. We provide everything. There will be no cost to you. So if you are interested in engaging, if you are interested in bringing this film back to your local chapter or group or diaspora community, please just go download the app or to the website and request a free screening, and you'll hear directly from one of our campaigners, thanks to the support we've received on the island of Bermuda and around the world from people who want to see this systemic change. As Bondi had said, moving towards your questions, I wanted to piggyback on the most brilliant point I've heard that Bondi had just said about this culture of corruption not staying in the Congo. I'm an American. I think for many obvious reasons, there was much I needed the world to see admitted on the behalf of Americans, and getting American officials to admit their wrongdoing in recent decades was one of my calls to action. And I'm now seeing a very ugly manifestation of this type of politics, deregulation politics, this kind of backed politics in my own country. You're no strangers to this kind of political movement, and we see it sweeping around the world. And so Bondi, I think, if anything, that point to sit on all of our shoulders, this isn't a Congo struggle solely. This is a global struggle orchestrated by a handful of kleptocrats. They just happen to be, you know, creating the greatest harm in Congo today. How that spreads and how that comes here to the UK and the US, it's really up to us as how aggressively we want to combat this culture of corruption, how much longer we want to allow businesses housed here in this city, in the city I come from, to continue business as usual. A question about the African Union. This was a Congolese-led production. And so individuals in the film, you know, most notably Fidel Bafilemba, he's a former rebel commander turned human rights activist, really led production of this film with his group GADRN, a coalition of human rights mining organizations in North Kivu province, but by no means was the sole co-producer and leaders of the film and its narrative and research. A very broad cross-section of Congolese civil society led production of this Congolese narrative, and they focused in on the stakeholders seen in the film mining at Katanga. But that's not to say that an 80-minute film is the whole story. This is the most important parts of the story. I'll pass it on, sorry.
Yeah, because we're already 3 minutes over time, so I can ask brief.
Very quickly. I'll be honest, I have no idea what the implication of the question about whether the Clintons made a killing on Rwanda and the Congo conflict. I wouldn't know. I honestly can't answer that. I'm not convinced that AMR is actually Bill Clinton's company. I think it just has its headquarters in his hometown. But again, if you can point me differently, then I'd be glad to see the evidence. On the Israelis, very quickly, Dan Gertler is the central figure to the most damaging deals that have been done in DRC in the last 5 or 6 years, and he is Israeli, and I was referring to the SEC evidence, which doesn't name co-conspirators. It merely describes them, and he is described as an infamous Israeli businessman. It's actually very important that he's from Israel because his grandfather set up the Israeli Diamond Exchange. He arrived in DRC in his 20s with a letter of introduction from his grandfather, which allowed him to make the connection to the now president, Joseph Kabila, at the time. Gertler is so important because it's a mesh of informal networks in DRC meeting the formality of the financial systems of the rest of the world. And the mesh, the interface is Dan Gertler.
Madam, we're trying to listen to the panelists. I did give you the floor. Can we please listen to his response? Thank you very much.
This man is central to this. I do not say the Israelis are central. This one Israeli billionaire, Dan Gertler, is absolutely central.
Okay, and I'm going to take the last respondent. Last respondent.
Well, I would probably address the last two questions to do with the AU as well as the, if you were elected president of the Congo, where would you start? The first one in relation to AU, I have to say that as a Congolese, I'm not impressed with the AU. In fact, I'm very disappointed with the AU. And it's actually an institution that should be the last to speak, because when it comes to the Congo, they've actually been complicit to what has happened in the Congo. Whenever Congolese people have actually demonstrated and asked for change, the AU has been silent. In fact, they've actually supported the current president. They've sent a so-called peace negotiator or somebody who can actually negotiate, facilitate the national dialogue. And what he has effectively done is actually given carte blanche to the current president so that he can have an excuse to postpone elections. And how can you trust such an institution? And it's almost like a club of corrupt leaders coming together with one aim to keep themselves in power. And really so disappointed and disgusting. If I'm speaking as a Congolese person. The second point I wanted to make, if ever one became president in the Congo, is really to make sure that we have institutions that are running properly, so that all the change we demanding around the world, so that when transparency is starting to take, having the impact we desire, that the money will actually go to the people, not to the corrupt few.
Thank you.